The cost of the war in Vietnam to the people of the United States is the theme of the New Statesman editorial.
Now seems a good time to take stock of just what price is being paid for just what ends. Price, in the most literal sense. On the 29th of January, President Johnson signed a budget which included $26,000 million for Vietnam. The once despised and improvident French have been able recently not only to talk of the weakness of the dollar, but to cause the United States Treasury genuine alarm. Without the war, such things would hardly be credible. Price in manpower. By the end of last year, nearly 16,000 American lives had been lost, half of them in that year alone. Price in influence. Vietnam has become the stick with which American prestige is beaten, privately and publicly, all over the world.
The New Statesman. The Economist praises the skills of the Communist Commander-in-Chief, but thinks it sees through his strategy.
The more one looks at the offensive General Giap has been running since the autumn, and which led to the attacks on the towns, the more it looks as if its real aim is not a military one at all. Its aim is political, if possible to shape American public opinion into electing a peacemaking president in November. Failing that, to get negotiations going on relatively favorable terms before the Americans' firepower eats deeper and deeper into the communists' hold of the backcountry. General Giap might have preferred to hold his hand until closer to November, but he's obliged to strike now because the weather will turn against him in the spring. It is an attempt conducted with brilliant tactical dash to force a settlement before it's too late.
The Economist. The Manchester Guardian Weekly tries to discern the motives behind the events in Vietnam.
Each side hopes for a final push to force its opponent to the negotiating table, but such hopes tend to be illusory. What promises to be a final push too often turns out to be an act of escalation that leaves behind no visible advantage. Optimists in Hanoi may hope that the Khe San battle will enable the Viet Cong to occupy the northern provinces of South Vietnam. On the other hand, it could equally well lead the Americans into Laos or into North Vietnam. It cannot alter the political difficulties of the American position. This was depressingly emphasized by last week's sudden resignation of General Nguyen Duc Thanh, who had led the rural pacification program and the anti-corruption drive in the South Vietnamese Army and Civil Service. He appears to have resigned in disgust at the lack of progress in both these vital efforts.
The Manchester Guardian Weekly. The Spectator sympathizes with what it calls the frustrations of a superpower.
It's one of the ironies of history that the discovery of an ultimate weapon of mass destruction, so costly to produce and deliver that it's beyond the means of any but the richest, most powerful, and most advanced nations of the world, has tilted the balance of power in favor of the small battalions. A general mobilization order, the dispatch of a gunboat, or a small expeditionary force, was sufficient to enable the leading powers of 19th century Europe to deal economically with lesser nations which resisted them. The same techniques are less successful in the 1960s. Notwithstanding the presence of 500,000 American troops, and after 3 years of full-scale war waged with all the most sophisticated conventional weapons in the American armory, North Vietnamese guerrillas were to mount a major assault on the center of Saigon and other supposedly secure cities of South Vietnam.
The Spectator. The Americans cannot win, says the New Statesman.
America's war aims have altered as often as its troop levels. But three main objectives stand out. To safeguard the freedom and welfare of the people of South Vietnam, to safeguard the freedom and welfare of other Asians threatened by communist expansionism, and to safeguard the American people themselves, threatened with loss of power, if not with actual invasion, by 1 billion nuclear-armed Chinese. On the most straightforward analysis, all three are questionable.
The New Statesman. The American people show signs, thinks the Spectator, of weariness with their worldwide work.
There are signs of a gathering groundswell of opinion in the United States in favor of early withdrawal from global involvements. The conventional wisdom, characteristically slow to adapt itself to circumstances, denounced such suggestions as neo-isolationism and holds up its hands in horror at the thought of the power vacuums which would be created by American withdrawal. In reality, the logic of the nuclear stalemate makes it safer for the superpowers to leave their allies to fight their own wars, and either infinitely dangerous or else infinitely frustrating for them to intervene. The Russians seem to have learned this lesson. If the Vietnam War succeeds in bringing it home to the United States, it will not have been fought in vain.
The Spectator. The latest attacks could be damaging to the Viet Cong case, says The Economist.
The probability is that it will end up as a propaganda defeat for the Viet Cong. Certainly, the Viet Cong could not be stopped from getting into the cities. That will impress the nervous. But in doing so, the suicide squads have caused a lot of civilian deaths. This time, it is the Viet Cong's victims in the horror pictures. That should help to restore the balance of emotion about this war.
The Economist. The press has linked the fighting in Vietnam with the incident of Korea. The capture of the United States intelligence ship, the Pueblo, by North Korea has drawn attention to methods of electronic warfare. The New Scientist.
Stories of Russian trawlers have tended to give the impression that only one side went in for this sort of thing. But there's no doubt that the United States effort is as great, and probably greater than that of the Russians. Nor are the superpowers the only ones involved. The Israelis showed the effectiveness of electronic eavesdropping by launching their first all-important airstrike of the June war at an hour when they knew most of the Egyptian high command would be in the air en route to a meeting. Just the sort of situation in which Egyptian reaction would be slow and in which anti-aircraft missile crews would be reluctant to launch their missiles because of the danger of shooting down their own generals.
The New Scientist. The argument about the policy of the British government and about the political standing of the Prime Minister continues to have a place in the weeklies. The Spectator lends its voice to the debate.
Mr. Wilson is not in any sense of the word an evil man. His private conduct is beyond reproach. His particular style of leadership, it is true, is aesthetically displeasing to those who care about these things, but that is a relatively minor failing. The real charge against him is simply that in spite of his considerable abilities, and partly perhaps because of some of them, he has proved a total failure as a prime minister. In the 3.25 years he has held the office, there is not a single important area in which his policies have proved successful. No doubt he has had bad luck. Conditions have not been easy. But that is beside the point. He has been put to the test and has failed. And there is no place for failures in the highest office in the land.
The Spectator. Not enough attention is being paid to the real issues, says the Manchester Guardian Weekly.
We are, as Mr. Anthony Wedgwood Benn, the Minister of Technology, told a Labour Party meeting, at a turning point in British history. Yet Parliament and ministers appear to be absorbed in secondary affairs. The end of what Mr. Benn calls the long retreat from empire must be matched by the fresh initiative which is needed to make devaluation work. This must come from a government of the left, not because Labour has made its bed and must lie in it, but because a government of the right would try to turn the clock back. The present government's decision to withdraw from the Far East remains much the boldest, most important, and in its results, the most promising measure in the package, and the Conservatives reject it. Having taken this decision, the government must not allow itself to be distracted by rebellions and their consequences.
The Manchester Guardian Weekly. The editor of Punch is optimistic about the state of the nation.
Britain is beginning to gear itself to the new era of large-scale production and neo-technic industrial science. This past year has seen mergers galore aimed at wider markets and marketing, improved design, and advanced production methods. It is reasonable to suppose that these merged industrial units will operate more effectively and efficiently if they're guaranteed a large home market for their products. Cost per unit should be reduced, and there should be more money for research into production techniques, design, and selling. If American industry thrives on a vast domestic market, it is reasonable to suppose that British industry would fare better and be in better shape to export competitively if it enjoyed maximum support from homegrown consumers.
Punch. One of the British government's worries in the past few weeks has been a rebellion of left-wing Labour MPs over cuts in the social services. Tribune states their case.
We do not deny that the road is difficult and fraught with great political dangers. Neither did we deny that the sweeping defence cuts, such as those east of Suez, had to be made in the face of bitter opposition from the services lobby, the oil lobby, and the American government. but it is the only way which will give the Labour government real control over Britain. Its enemies have decided to push the government back on the issue of social service expenditure. One needs only to reflect on who cheered when the recent cuts were made: the capitalist press, the bankers, and the city. They'll now try to push the government back again at the budget. Labour's rank and file know well that another retreat of this nature could seal the fate of the government. That is why they're angry and in the mood which pushes them to pass critical resolutions and call on their members not to support the social service cuts.
Tribune. The argument going on between the Cuban leader, Dr. Fidel Castro, and his Russian patrons intrigues the Manchester Guardian Weekly.
Dr. Castro's split with Moscow became decisive last August at the conference of the Organization of Latin American Solidarity, when the Cubans publicly attacked the Russians for trading with established Latin American regimes. He has added insult to injury since then by boycotting the anniversary celebrations of the Russian Revolution in Moscow, and, more significantly, by deciding not to attend the Budapest conference at which the Russians still hope to line up loyal support in the ideological battle against China. Last weekend's purge confirms this anti-Soviet trend. The most important event since this conference was, of course, Che Guevara's death. This clearly was a fearful blow for Havana and seriously weakened Dr. Castro's policy of support for guerrilla movements throughout the continent. But, paradoxically, it may explain the continuing anti-Soviet line. It would be too humiliating for Dr. Castro to admit publicly the failure of Che's guerrilla strategy.
The Manchester Guardian Weekly. The Economist also explains why Cuba dislikes the Soviet Union.
Cuba's clash with Russia over what should be done about Latin America's revolutionary movements has acquired new emotional bitterness through Che Guevara's death in Bolivia last October. Guevara's death and the crushing of the small Bolivian guerrilla movement confirmed the Russians and the orthodox Latin American communist parties in their belief that the time is not ripe for armed revolution. To Dr. Castro, one of the least tight-lipped of men, it was a personal blow to which he reacted by a long, loud shout that the struggle would continue. Back in August, Dr. Castro had attacked the Russians and East Europeans for developing their trade and other relations with Latin American governments. Now, in the heightened tension after the Bolivian fiasco, he feels betrayed.
The Economist. Although when the weeklies went to press, no practical steps had been taken, the Manchester Guardian Weekly welcomes President Nasser's agreement to clear the Great Bitter Lakes section of the Suez Canal.
This is small but useful progress. It does not yet reopen the canal to navigation, a proposition which still faces the twin obstacles of Israel's presence on the East Bank and Israel's demand to be allowed to use the canal. But it is a beginning. 4 weeks ago, the Israelis were still refusing to allow the clearance unless they were consulted, and the Egyptians were refusing to do any consulting. Appropriately and hopefully, the solution was found through the United Nations. Politically, the concession owes much to President Nasser's desire to get back onto better terms with the West, particularly Britain. In dealing with the British, the canal is a useful asset, but it is of little value when blocked. More significant concessions might eventually follow.
Roundup of the Weeklies, a British Broadcasting Corporation production, comes to you through facilities of the Broadcasting Foundation of America.